Thanks so much, Kevin. I'm from the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, and I'm here to talk to you about the future of conservatism in K-12 education. But in all seriousness, it's a real honor to be here today, and in particular to address the topic of federalism and how the next generation can restore it. In 1792, Congressman James Madison, on the floor of Congress, laid out an impossible dream of people in New England several hundred years ago. What he described was K-12 education being subsidized under the general clause of the Constitution, and how ridiculous something like that would be. It makes you really curious to know what he would think of NCLB and the Obama administration's agenda in public education. But as you know, the founders were very far-sighted folks. They were widely read in Plato and Aristotle and Polybius and Tacitus and more contemporary thinkers like Machiavelli and John Locke and others. What they learned from those ancient and modern examples and lessons was that compound republics are the ones that degenerate much more slowly, and that simple forms of government degenerate very, very quickly. And as part of their constitutional scheme of a large, balanced federal republic, within that, the national government has very precise and clear role to play, and the state governments have an equally clear and precise role to play. The framers were extraordinarily wise, understanding that the civic-mindedness most closely connected to people was the ones that helped perpetuate classical republicanism, and that those local civic-minded organizations that you'd find around cities and towns and states were the best guardians of those kinds of rights and liberties. And this is the kind of thing that both John Adams and Thomas Jefferson, though they were political rivals and rivals in the election of 1800, they agreed on this. And that's why the Constitution in Massachusetts and the Constitution in Virginia are very clear and specific. Each one of them have paragraph-length descriptions about what it is that the state responsibilities are in elementary education. By contrast, the U.S. Constitution, as many of you know, is virtually silent on the role of education, and that wasn't an accident. They understood quite wisely that state governments really are the guardians of K-12 education, or should be. Now, Massachusetts, going back to John Adams and certainly through Horace Mann in the 1830s, has always met that challenge. They have inspired great leaders, and Horace Mann himself was considered the father of public education in this country. But as we also know, by the late 20th century, public education was in very grave and serious condition, and which is why President Reagan in 1983, in a commission that he authorized, authored the A Nation at Risk report, which laid out in line and verse all the shortcomings and failings in public education. But what they were very careful about doing is not making prescriptions to how to solve education reform issues. They understood, too, that education reform was a local matter. Now, Massachusetts was really one of the only states that in the last 20 years or so has really, in a comprehensive way, answered that challenge. In 1993, Governor Weld, in conjunction with Democratic leaders in the House and the Senate, crafted what we call the grand bargain, which was a great deal of additional state funding in the last 20 years. Both state and local funding has been approximately $100 billion in exchange for all the hard things that people in K-12 education never want to do, which is focus on high academic standards. So just to give you a sense of what a standard is, there's the curriculum that's taught in the classroom, but the standard is the scaffolding that's outlined by the state. It's the level of expectations that the state has. And the standards that were developed in Massachusetts, by every measure and by every yardstick and people across the spectrum, were regarded as the best in the country. The American Federation of Teachers, the Fordham Institute, others have knowledge that the standards that Massachusetts had in place were absolutely fantastic. So what was in those standards? It was Homer and Dante and Chaucer and Shakespeare and Mark Twain and Moby Dick and all the rich poetry and literature that you would want your children to know in order to become fully human, as well as very rigorous math and science standards, because people in Massachusetts had had enough with the fuzzy math, and they knew precisely what Galileo said, that science is written in the language of mathematics. Coupled with those high-quality standards was high-stakes testing that every high school student had to pass in order to graduate. They were not fancy, they were not complicated, but it was a one test that students had to take in order to graduate. And then making sure that there was accountability throughout the entire public system, there was teacher testing too. So any new teacher coming into the classroom had to be tested on the same kind of academic material that they were going to be expected to teach to their students. And near and dear to Pioneer's heart, because we're certainly one of the big advocates of school choice and charter schools, they included provisions in there that allowed charter schools to flourish in Massachusetts, because fundamentally the parent-student involvement in education starts with families being able to pick their schools for their children to attend. And the results really have been remarkable. On the charter school front, we have some of the best charter schools in the country. We've been extraordinarily rigorous and careful about shutting down the ones that don't work. So while across the country it's been sort of a mixed bag with charter schools, the charter schools in Massachusetts are so good, particularly the urban charter schools, are so good that they take students that are largely poor and minority, and within 2 or 3 years they are outperforming the students in some of the wealthiest suburbs in the state. So that's the charter school success. The overall success of it too has been historic. On the 2005 NAEP testing, the nation's report card, Massachusetts was the first state in the union to run the table. Every grade tested, Massachusetts was number one. We did that again in 2007, 2009, and 2011. No state had ever done it once, and Massachusetts done it four times. We tested in 2007 as our own individual country in math and science, and our eighth graders were tied for first in the world. So Massachusetts accomplished a lot of the things that that a nation at risk outlined in the early 1980s, and it has been a historic success that we're proud of. But I don't tell you these things by way of bragging about my state. The reason why I tell you is that states can, given the proper leadership and laws, states can drive education reform. A lot of the people that are proponents of national standards for 20 years or more have really had a great deal of skepticism that only the federal that states are able to do this, and that only the federal government is able to get us to the educational promised land. So in 2006, Governor Deval Patrick was elected, and then in 2008, we had the benevolence of the Obama administration, and we had a push for what they call Race to the Top, which is a federal grant where states were competing for about $5 billion of their own money. The proviso was that they would have to sign on to all the agenda items that the Obama administration wanted. There were several states that that decided not to adopt, Texas most notably. But many of the states, and even states with Republican governors, signed on wholeheartedly because money was really running short at the state level. The interesting thing about it is that state legislatures were systematically bypassed. So there's only a couple of state legislatures of the now 46 states that have adopted Common Core, which is the name for the national standards and the tests. But only a couple of those state legislatures actually had bills or discussions or debates. It's a fascinating feature of the national standards is that the Obama administration have realized that the number one goal of the teachers' unions for the last 25 or 30 years since the establishment of the U.S. Department of Education was to have national standards and national tests. In fact, one of the big proponents of national standards is a guy named Mark Tucker. And right after Bill Clinton was elected, he wrote a very well-known letter at this point that was read into the congressional record called the Dear Hillary Letter. And what it did is that it mapped out an entire system, nationalized standards and tests, which really converted American public education into a workforce development system, not listening to any of the examples that we now know from the 90s where you can boost academic standards. The Obama administration has continued to proceed with this, but they haven't done it alone. They've had generous help from the Gates Foundation. So the Gates Foundation, too, believes that we ought to have national standards and consequently has spent about $100 million on all the various trade organizations in and around public education in Washington, D.C. The two major forces are the Governors Association, the Council of Chief State School Officers, in conjunction with the Fordham Institute, the Albert Shanker Center at the AFT. And what's really notable about this collection of players who have been around public education for a long time, back in the 80s, Bill Bennett used to call them the blob, is that over the last 25 years or so, they can't cite one place, one state, in some instances, one school where they've actually boosted student achievement. So if that wasn't enough, then the Obama administration used stimulus money. They used about $350 million of stimulus money to help subsidize two national testing consortia who will be operating and developing tests in the next couple of years outside of the public realm. So what does this mean for high-standard states like Massachusetts or Indiana or California or Minnesota? Well, of course, Governor Deval Patrick is an ally of the president, so Massachusetts was going to adopt all along. But if they wanted to make sure that they had an insurance policy, so the Gates Foundation, who had paid for the development of the standards themselves, also paid for three different independent evaluations of the standards. It's sort of an odd case where you have someone playing judge and jury in their own case, particularly so when it's going to be impacting 45 or 50 million school children. Anyway, Massachusetts did finally adopt, but not before Pioneer Institute did four independent crosswalks using nationally recognized scholars in English language arts and math, people like Sandra Stotsky, Zev Werman, a Silicon Valley engineer who had worked on the development of the very high-quality math standards in California, and Jim Milgram, who's a professor emeritus at Stanford University in mathematics. And what we found when we evaluated Common Core against high standard states, every step of the way, Common Core was of low quality. So did they aim high? Was it really a race to the top? No, it was not. It was a race to the middle. To give you a little example of that, this is the line from one of the reviewers. The Common Core provides vague, overly technical guidelines for teachers. For example, Massachusetts standards call for students in grades 3 and 4 to identify subject and verb agreement in a simple sentence. The national standards call for those teachers to, quote, use modal auxiliaries to convey various conditions. So all of the various features that you found in the previous standards in places like Massachusetts and Indiana, which were rich in the classics, Homer and Shakespeare and Mark Twain and all that, that's all gone. So Massachusetts' commitment and its success to literature was really the reason why we had done so well. The Common Core has the belief that has actually no research to back it up, that students should be reading over 50% of their work in their K-12 experience and 70% by the time they get to high school, what they call informational text. So the examples that they use are Federal Reserve manuals and things like that. So the first focus of our work was on the academic quality. The second dimension of it, because most people in public education have known for decades that there are federal laws that actually explicitly prohibit the federal government from developing national standards and tests, we commissioned Kent Talbert and Bob Itell, who was the general counsel and deputy general counsel for U.S. Department of Education under the second Bush administration. We asked them to take a very careful look at Common Core, Race to the Top, the conditional NCLB waivers that were developed by the Obama administration. And there's a handout here that I've distributed that has a summary of their paper, and George Will last March did a column on it too. But, you know, not surprisingly, they found this excellent paper maps it out in really punishing legal detail. That great conservative Lyndon Johnson's Elementary and Secondary Education Act of 1965 is very clear and explicit. There can be no national standards, testing, or curriculum. The General Education Provisions Act of 1970, too, is very clear and explicit. There cannot be national standards or tests. The 1979 enabling legislation setting up the U.S. Department of Education itself, too, is very, very explicit. So there are these three separate federal laws. So these national standards or tests are going to be impacting, again, 45 or 50 million school children. As many of you may know, the states and localities pay for 90% of public education in this country. So you'd assume that the proponents of the national standards, I mean, the Gates Foundation is a $40 billion foundation, so you'd expect that they would tell everybody or do some kind of mapping out of what this is actually going to cost. Well, they haven't. And we decided to do that, too. So we had a former congressional staffer who had long experience in both D.C. and at the state level take a look at it. And we came up with a very low-ball figure of $16 billion that again, 90% of that will be borne by the states and localities because, you know, of course, they've got a lot of extra money on hand these days. Texas alone, who, again, opted not to adopt national standards, it was projected that their cost would have been $3 billion. And so what are the big cost drivers? There's professional development, training teachers on these new standards, new textbooks. So irrespective whether a state like Massachusetts only got new textbooks a couple years ago, they're going to need all new textbooks and all new testing material and all new professional development for all the teachers. But the biggest cost driver, the major cost driver, is $7 billion, and that is for the technology for the testing. So now you can begin to get a clearer picture why the Gates Foundation and Microsoft might actually be interested in national standards and tests. Thankfully, there's been an effort in the last several years that's gradually gaining steam. So in eight states, and it's driven, frankly, largely by outraged mothers who see the national standards as a dumbing down of mathematics standards. But working with these parents and Heritage and Cato and SPN and American Principles Project, and there's an excellent chapter in Stanley Kurtz's new book on the Obama administration, we've been working with folks across the country to try to roll back what is the equivalent of a federal takeover in healthcare. It's refining it in education, too. And because the future of federalism, there can't be a more important battleground than in the lives of our children and the kinds of education they receive. We believe that, as most people do, that education should be the civil rights issue of our era. And Pioneer, again, is a full-throated supporter of school choice and charter schools. But we also think it's equally important that education, K-12 education, is the Bill of Rights issue of our era, too. And the Bill of Rights isn't just a list of recommendations. It's actually the law of the land. Thanks.